Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Robin Wall Kimmerer is a mother, a scientist, and an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi.
Potawatomi.
Mm-hmm. Potawatomi Nation. Her books include Braiding Sweetgrass and Gathering Moss. We're broadcasting live from the Deadwood Mountain Grand at the South Dakota Festival of Books. Robin is here with me. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm delighted.
I've been putting pictures of this book on social media, and every time I get ready to, I love this book. And you can see I'm marking up the pages. The writing in it is so beautiful. So first, thank you not only for being here, but for bringing this book into my life and to the lives of your readers. Mm. You get that a lot.
It's a delight to know when sort of the seeds of this story have fallen on fertile ground. You don't know what they're going to grow into.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that the stories are being carried and nurtured by people from so many different backgrounds. So
and within hours of reading just the preface and I think chapter one, my daughter came up to me and asked me to braid her hair. And then I was writing about that experience and this book to her and to the braiding of her hair and then to being a writer and all that. So that's my fangirl moment. I can't, sometimes I just can't hold back. It's tough. Tell me about your childhood and growing up and really learning how to pay deep attention to the world that you would need as a scientist in the future and as a writer in the future.
I was lucky enough to grow up in a family that, as my mom said, we didn't have any money, so all we could do would be to be outside. We would share a single pair of binoculars so we went birding and so forth. And I lived in the country and had the opportunity to really spend lots of time with who I considered to be my community and my companions, which was the natural world. Mm-hmm. I was that kid who would jump off the school bus and, you know, throw my jacket away and then go out into the fields until dinner time. Mm-hmm. So it was the natural world was an endless source of curiosity for me. But it was more than that, because our family was quite distant geographically from our Potawatomi family in Oklahoma. We had our extended family, but I had no access to cultural knowledge, to elders to guide me. And I had so many questions, so much that I wanted to know. And there is a real way in which those plants became my teachers.
Did you feel that separation and that longing even as a child? Or did that come later on when you sort of knew what you had been missing?
No, it was from the very beginning, because as I would ask my dad things about our culture, I wanted to know stories, I wanted to know words for this or that, and he would be very honest with me and say, no, that was all left behind at the boarding school. My grandfather was one of the children who was taken at just 9 years old, put on the train east for Carlisle Indian School, where all of that, the attention was to wash it all away. And so from a very early time, I was deeply aware of what had been taken and longed to have it back.
Were you aware of a responsibility or a yearning to find those things, recreate them? You talk a little bit about ceremony and your dad and the coffee and in sort of inventing or creating these things that were lost at boarding school moments.
Yeah, I'm so glad you called to that story of my father and what we called a homemade ceremony, because while I grew up in a family where we didn't have Potawatomi language or what I would have thought as Potawatomi teachings, after I was able to reconnect to our traditions, I realized we absolutely did, that my father would always give gratitude for the natural world around him with this little ceremony that just came from his heart, and I think came from a kind of deep memory as well.
Yeah. And then you decide to become a scientist, and you go to school and ask the question about beauty, and they say, from page 41, if you wanted to study beauty, you should go to art school. Tell me about that moment.
That was my first day of university, and when I was asked, why do you want to become a botanist? And I answered in that way, because the world is so beautiful, I want to understand that. And honestly, I was crushed when I was told that beauty is not the sort of thing with which scientists concern themselves. And so I tried again. I wanted to know about why certain plants were good for medicine and why these bent for baskets and those didn't. And I was told also that's not science. There was very clearly no room for indigenous ways of thinking about plants in the academy. And that was a deep discouragement to me. Mm-hmm. I'd like to tell my students, and my students love to hear, that I nearly failed freshman botany as a result of that worldview difference. But it was the plants that carried me through because I was so fascinated by everything about them that I willingly went into the scientific worldview to learn everything that I could about plants, all the while knowing that it was a different worldview than the one I came with.
Were you intimidated by it? Now, take us back to this boarding school moment, and now you're having your own moment with the university that says, you know, in a different way, the same thing, which is this does not matter, and this is not the question you will ask here, this is not the language you will speak here. Mm-hmm. But you didn't find that to be intimidating or as a reason to turn and walk away.
I did find it very intimidating. Absolutely. I felt very much at sea and questioned whether I belonged there. But again, it was the plants that pulled me through that, mm-hmm. because it was them who I wanted to learn about. And so I managed, and it was a long pathway back to be able to try to put those worldviews together, yeah. those ways of seeing the world together. And that's really what Braiding Sweetgrass is about.
What are some of those benchmarks or key moments that you remember where you learned how to integrate these two worlds?
One of the most important, really watershed moments for me is that I was, after I had gotten my PhD in botany, and of course I thought, oh, I'm so proud, I really know my plants now. And I was invited out of the clear blue sky to a gathering of traditional elders to just sit and listen for 4 days about plant knowledge. And I walked away from that gathering a different person, because I came to understand that traditional knowledge holders knew so much more than I did, and they knew it in a deep and multidimensional way that science could never touch. The elders I was sitting with knew why, or were investigating why the world was so beautiful, and how do we keep it that way. And so that for me was the beginning of other teachers coming into my life and helping me on that pathway.
That had to be humbling and validating at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. I just remember it as feeling like, you know, sometimes when you walk into your home and you just get that little scent of something that says, I'm home, mm-hmm. you know, maybe something on the stove or just the way your home smells. That's how I remember that gathering of, oh, this is home. These are people who understand the way I always thought about plants. So it was liberating.
Yeah.
It was liberating and daunting.
When I introduced you, I said first that you were a mother, because when I find you on different interviews with other people, as you introduce yourself, you'll often introduce yourself, and the word mother will be first in the list of the other things that you've done. If I had a PhD, I don't know, I might lead with that. But tell me why that is something that you often value to be first in the list. That's what I lead with. That's the first thing I need you to know about me.
I think that being a mother is my most important work, and now being a grandmother. And it is a bit of resistance, Lori, to that notion that we are defined by the letters associated with our names or our academic degrees. I really try to cultivate this sense of wholeness between mind, body, emotion, and spirit. And, you know, leading with, I am a professor of, discounts all those other things. So I want to start with the thing which is most important first. And I've been really happy to see that a number of my colleagues who will look at that and say, well, that's a different way to introduce yourself. You know what? I'm a dad first. I'm a this first. I'm an artist first. And so in a way, it has been liberating, not just for me, but for others as well.
What do you wish you understood about plants that is still beyond your grasp?
Oh, everything.
Everything.
Everything. You know, one of the things that fascinates me deeply is that when the most of the world looks at plants and views them as primitive, as lower, as other, because they can't move, and we primarily look at that, oh, well, that's too bad, they can't move. I love to reverse that and say, what is life like when you can't go chasing around after mm-hmm. things, when you have to live more slowly and deliberately, and if you can't move, you must invest in mutual relationships because you're all together in the long run. Mm. And I wish I knew how plants thought about that.
Yeah. At moss being so small, another lesson as well about surviving.
Oh, mosses. They are my true loves in the plant world. And one of the things that I love about them is just as you intimate, because they are so often overlooked, they are our teachers of what it means to be humble and small and the beauty that comes from that. While mosses are the smallest plants on earth, they are in some ways the most important. In building soil, they give so much more than they take. They teach us to live with nature instead of fighting against nature. They are generous, they're beautiful, and all it takes is attention to appreciate them. Mm.
I'd like to know how they think about that. Do you think plants have some kind of awareness?
I know they do.
How do I get my mind around that?
Yeah. Because the awareness and the intelligence, the sentience that plants possess is so different from animal ways of being, it's really hard for us even to imagine. But what we've come to understand through Western science of plant neurobiology and plant cognition is that they seem to have a distributed sort of consciousness, a distributed sort of intelligence, in that all parts of their bodies, because they're not moving around, are sensing, awaring, being aware, making decisions. And so it's such a different kind of consciousness that we really can, as you say, hardly wrap our minds around it.
What's the role of imagination in science and to learn the thing that needs to be understood next, to get to a deeper level of understanding and therefore living? How do we increase our imagination?
Well, what a wonderful question. When I think about increasing our imagination, I like to look to all of the other beings with whom we share the planet. We are not alone here, right? We are just one species in this whole beautiful democracy of species. And if we open ourselves to the fact that all of these other beings have creative ways of living, we can look to them as sources and guidance for us. I think about one of my Haudenosaunee colleagues who talks about the Mohawk concept of imagination, because in the West we think of imagination is in our own heads, and they say that imagination is in fact the place where the minds of all of the beings meet, and so we as humans can dip into that imagination to learn.
Robin Wall Kimmer is my guest. The book, Braiding Sweetgrass. I love this book, and I love you for being here. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Chi mi gwech.